Bill.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Eberhardt. Mr. Goodman.
May it please the court.
Mr. Buckley.
I represent Ivan Eberhardt, and I would like to begin by addressing the argument about the sufficiency of the evidence. Mr. Eberhardt was charged in a two-count indictment. The first count was the conspiracy count. It named one co-conspirator, and that is Mr. Bolden. And it alleged that Eberhardt and Bolden conspired together over a one-year period to distribute cocaine. It identified one overt act in support of that conspiracy, and that is that on December 15th, 2 days before Mr. Eberhardt's arrest, he was alleged to have been at the River Oaks Mall delivering 2 kilograms of cocaine to Mr. Bolden. That mall transaction was also charged in count two as a substantive count. At the trial, Mr. Eberhardt established, through the testimony of 5 witnesses, including 2 police officers, that he could not have been at the mall on the evening of December 15th. On that day, his house had been burglarized, and he was home repairing the window and installing burglar bars. The jury acquitted him of the count two mall transaction, but convicted him of conspiracy, and it's our position that the evidence is insufficient, that no rational jury could have found the elements of a conspiracy on this record. What evidence does the government offer for conspiracy? First of all, this is a case where there's no physical evidence. The defendant was not caught with any drugs, cash, weapons. There's no unexplained law. And that is not unheard of in a conspiracy case. But what is unheard of here is that there were no eyewitnesses. No one came to court to say that they saw Mr. Eberhardt sell drugs, possess drugs, buy drugs. His lone accuser is Mr. Bolden, and although Mr. Bolden was a father of the government deemed him too unreliable to put him on the witness stand. There were tapes between Bolden and Eberhardt which were played at trial, but these were not tapes recorded during the life of the conspiracy. These were tapes recorded after Mr. Bolden was arrested and cooperating with the government. And as this court explained in the recent case of United States versus Tolliver, this court explained the legal basis under which tape-recorded conversations between the defendant and a cooperating informant are admissible. And they're admissible because the statements of the defendant are admissions of a party opponent. In that case, in the Tolliver case, the tapes were recorded while the defendant was selling drugs to the informant. So his statements on the tape were admissions of intent to sell drugs. And the statements of the informant on the tape are not admissible for the truth, but simply admissible, as this court explained, to put the defendant's admissions in context. Here, if you look at the transcripts of the tapes, the defendant makes no admissions. The closest thing to an admission is on the first set of tapes, where Mr. Bolden says in the soft voice, "I need about 2 more," and Mr. Eberhardt says, "Okay," and then he says something unintelligible. Now, the government's position is that Mr. Bolden was talking about drugs, and that by saying "Okay," Mr. Eberhardt was admitting, first of all, that he had delivered the 2 kilos the day before, and that he was agreeing to sell more drugs. The problem with that is, first of all, the jury found that he didn't deliver the 2 kilos the day before. And secondly, if he was agreeing...
What are your legal arguments? Because the government says that, you know, doesn't want us to revisit issues decided previous rounds. So are you asking us to do that? Are you presenting new grounds that weren't cited or what?
In the appeal brief, Your Honor, we cited 6 errors. I believe 6 issues. One of them was sufficiency of the evidence. 3 of the errors we cited in the appeal brief have been rejected by this court in the previous opinion, and I'm not going to revisit those issues. The sufficiency of the evidence has not been addressed by this court.
And that's what you're arguing now?
Yes.
Is that all? Is that...
I'd like to argue the sufficiency of the evidence and also the admissibility of the tapes and also the issue of the Sears instruction.
Okay, thanks.
I intend to argue 3 issues. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
The second set of tapes is mostly incomprehensible. If you look at this is the face-to-face meeting between Eberhardt and Mr. Bolden. There's 2 threads of conversation, both of which were initiated by the informant. And the first is where the informant is telling Mr. Everhart about how he got stopped the day before by the DEA and released. Mr. Everhart's response is, tell me what happened. And the government's position is that because Mr. Everhart is curious about what happened with the DEA, that proves that he's in a conspiracy with Mr. Bolden, which, of course, is utter nonsense. The fact that somebody is curious about his friend's encounter with the DEA is not proof that they are in a conspiracy. The second thread of conversation on his tapes is Mr. Bolden begins talking about money. And he says, it's Christmas time, I'm down some money, I'm trying to get my money together, I lost some money. And Mr. Everhart's response is mostly, I don't understand what you're talking about. And his most Mr. Everhart's most coherent response comes at the end, where he says, man had heart left. The government, in its brief, says, the government writes that, quote, that this conversation about money is, quote, a conversation about the $3,000 that Bolden owed the defendant as a result of narcotics previously fronted to Bolden. Which I hope that Mr. Baku, when he stands up here, will retract that statement, because he's clearly not in the conversation. The defendant makes no such admission that he has a prior drug transaction with Mr. Bolden. Or at least I would like Mr. Baku to point to where in the transcript Mr. Bolden makes such an admission. So the tapes, it's our position that the tapes have almost zero evidentiary value in support of the conspiracy. That means only the defendant's confession. And this confession is not, it's not a bearing of the soul confession. This is what happened. The defendant was arrested. He denied everything. He denied any involvement with Bolden's drug dealing. He was placed in a holding cell. And the agents made it clear to Mr. Everhart that if he does not cooperate, he's going to the MCC. And subsequently,
is this confession corroborated by the garage? For the scales?
I would say no, Your Honor, for this reason. All that proves is that Mr. Everhart, when convinced that his only hope to avoid jail is to cooperate, was able to point out a house that had some relation to drugs. Now, if the government was able to prove that there was some connection between Bolden and that house, or if there was some connection between the person that Mr. Bolden later contacted on the phone in an attempt to drive by drugs from and that house, then there would be some corroboration. But all we know, and I would suggest that if any of us was in that situation, we could probably point to a house in the neighborhood that has drug activity in it. I don't think the fact that Mr. Everhart was able to do that is corroborates his confession.
After this garage is in the neighborhood where Everhart lived?
Judge, I'm not sure where it was. I'm not sure. I'd have to check that.
Well, we discovered near the scale there, though, right? The DEA discovered near the...
There was a scale. In this house, it was pointed out there were no drugs, but there were a couple of scales and I believe a web.
High-speed money counters?
And money counters. The defendant is allowed, after his arrest and he agrees to cooperate, he's allowed to go home and he's told to come back the next day with a number of persons he's going to buy drugs from to assist the agents. He makes some phone calls, unable to purchase any drugs, and he is arrested and charged. He spends 2.5 days in the custody of these agents. There's no recording of any of his statements. The agents could not produce any handwritten notes, but 3 months later they write a report saying he admitted that he was in a conspiracy with Mr. Bolden. Judge Vigil found that this confession was too unreliable to consider at sentencing. And Judge Vigil's reason for that, not that he didn't trust the agents, his reason was that because of the circumstances, Mr. Everhart had such a tremendous incentive to enhance his value as a witness that he didn't find his statements reliable. The other problem with the confession is that the government was unable to independently corroborate a single thing that Mr. Everhart told the agents. And besides that, at least two of the things that he told the agents were shown to be false. He apparently admitted to the agents that he had been at the mall 2 days earlier selling drugs to Mr. Bolden, which was an untrue statement. He also told the situations, and he could. He had pre-arrangements to pick up 20 kilograms of cocaine the next morning. He could do that for these agents, and he was unable to. Both those statements were false. Now, in Wong Sun, a case that I cite in my reply brief, the Supreme Court cautioned against convictions which rest solely on uncorroborated confessions, and it's our position that that's what we have here. And besides that, even if we're going to overlook the problems with the confession...
No, it was corroborated. No, that's not...
It's my position, Judge, that there was no corroboration.
No, that's true. Well, of course, the garage and, in fact, the conversation with Bolden.
Well, the conversations with Bolden proves that they knew each other, but that was not in dispute. In fact, it was...
Well, it depends how the conversation is interpreted. The garage is certainly corroboration. It doesn't mean it, you know, proves that everything you said was correct. It is corroboration.
Well, I would agree with you that it was corroboration if there was some linkage between that garage and the phone number that he brings in the next day of his supplier, or if there was some linkage of that garage to Mr. Eberhardt, but the government was unable to do that. In fact, the phone number that he brought in was registered to some person named Juan Martinez. There was no connection between that and that house that he pointed out. If I may move on to the Tape Foundation, this court has held consistently that there's two ways to authenticate a tape recording. And one is that the agent comes to court and testifies that the equipment was working and that the chain of custody was preserved and that the tapes were not tampered with. The second way is through a direct identification, where a witness who overheard the conversation as it was being recorded comes to court and says, "This tape accurately reflects what I heard." In this case, the only person who actually heard the conversation as it was being recorded was Mr. Bolden, who the government deemed too unreliable to put on the witness stand. So the logical thing would be for the government to use the other method of corroboration, foundation, which is to call an agent to say that the equipment was working and that there was no tampering. For some reason, which I don't understand, the government didn't do that. They tried to corroborate these tapes with an agent who heard only a portion of the conversation. And if this court were to accept that as foundation for tapes, it would be a departure from the decisions in the past. And besides, I would argue that it would be a dangerous departure, because what it would allow is one party to introduce tampered tapes by calling a witness who heard only a portion of the conversation and says that the portion that I heard is accurately reflected on the tape. That, to me, that is an insufficient foundation for tapes. The last issue that I'd like to address is the Sears instruction. And in this case, in my argument is that this is a case where the Sears instruction needed to be given. It's a carelessly worded indictment which says that the conspiracy continued until in or about December 1998. The defendant was arrested on December 16th, December 17th, 1998. The government plays tapes at trial where the informant is trying to get the defendant to agree to sell him cocaine, allegedly, and then the two meet. So certainly this is a situation where the jury could have thought the defendant's willingness to have some discussions on the tape and then to meet with Mr. Bolden as evidence of a conspiracy. And the jury should have been instructed that a conspiracy was impossible with Bolden after the day of Bolden's arrest.
Can you say some time?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bolden. Mr. Rathbun?
May it please the Court. The first argument the counsel made relating to the sufficiency, we did talk about last time we had argument in this case at some length, so I'll try to be brief. The evidence certainly was sufficient in this case. We had a confession from the defendant in this case where he admitted that he had been transacting in narcotics for over a year, that he had been shipping between or moving between 20 to 40 kilograms of cocaine a month, that he owed his source of supply, Tommy, $70,000, Tommy was the person that supplied him drugs and would supply him drugs either at 6 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock at night at a garage, and he identified that garage. Judge Posner has already indicated there's corroboration for the confession to the extent that the garage was actually searched and items were retrieved there. The confession is also corroborated by the tapes that were introduced into evidence. The tapes indicate, first, that there's a longstanding relationship between Charles Bolden and the defendant. The manner in which they talk on those tapes was suggestive that they talked in code. They talked about, I need two more. What flavor? During the meeting at the KFC, they met in a surreptitious fashion as well. They didn't go into the restaurant itself. They met in a car. And during their conversation, again, there's a lot of code language being used by Bolden, and Eberhardt seems to have a great interest in trying to determine what happened with the DEA. He keeps asking repeatedly during that tape, which is reflected in Government Exhibit 8, what happened with the police. Bolden, for his part, says, you think I'm wired or something? And the defendant doesn't seem to bat an eye after being asked, you know, you think I'm wired, challenged in that fashion. Mr. Bolden also indicates that he thought his phone was tapped. And again, the defendant in this case doesn't seem to be perturbed by the idea that he's talking to somebody who believes that his phone might have been tapped. There's also conversation, and counsel has asked me to address this issue about where in the transcript is there a conversation relating to the $40,000 debt. On pages 190 and 237 of the trial transcript, there is the following question from the prosecutor relating to the plan of meeting with Mr. Bolden and Ivan Eberhardt. What was the plan for Mr. Bolden when he was supposed to meet this defendant, individual E, later on that day? The plan was for Mr. Bolden to meet with E to discuss the previous cocaine transaction, to indicate to him that he had $40,000 of money to pay for the past transaction, and for us to subsequently, once Charles Bolden gave us a signal.
Who's the witness?
Pardon me?
Who's the witness?
This is Agent Glenn. And then on cross-examination, again, defense counsel now elicits the following question. You guys wanted a meeting? The DE agents, you guys wanted Eberhardt and Bolden to meet? Answer, that was part of our plan. Correct. Question, you instructed Bolden to talk about his previous transaction the 16th. You instructed him to do that. Correct? Answer, at the meeting? Question, yes. Answer, we instructed him to meet with Bolden to act as if he had the $40,000 United States currency that he owed to him for the previous 2 kilo cocaine transactions. That, taken in conjunction with what actually appeared on the recorded conversation at the Kentucky Fried Chicken, I think is sufficient evidence and supports the government's assertion in its brief that the purpose of the meeting was to talk about, in part, $40,000. Bolden is asked by Eberhardt, so how much money you got now? And Bolden responds, like 39.8. I think that there is no false representation made in the government's brief, and that the evidence supports that argument. There was some further argument relating to what Judge Zagel thought about the defendant's confession. My understanding of what Judge Zagel's conclusion was that he was not going to credit the defendant's confession with respect to the weight, that is, the amount of narcotics the defendant was transacting in. Judge Zagel obviously...
Could Eberhardt have called Bolden as a witness?
Yes, he could have. Judge Zagel actually mentioned on the record in his order with respect to the new trial that he was prepared to write Bolden in. There was reference both in the record and I believe in Judge Zagel's order indicating that Judge Bolden was in custody. And I also believe on the record that the defendant indicated they did not wish to call Mr. Bolden. And I think Judge Zagel had it right. He wasn't a missing witness. He was just a witness that nobody really wanted to call. There were some obvious credibility issues with him that had surfaced, and nobody obviously wanted to actually bring him into the mix, and for that reason, neither side chose to call him. And I don't think there's anything in the record to suggest either that Mr. Bolden was somehow peculiarly within the government's power to produce, because he was in prison. He wasn't pragmatically available only to the government in that there was no cooperation deal between the government and Mr. Bolden. There was this argument, one of the arguments that defense actually suggests has not been waived by the court's prior decision was this due process argument. I would submit that that argument was actually reached by this court during its prior opinion. That argument is that there was some sort of prosecutorial misconduct in this case, in that the prosecutor indicated on the record that there was no cooperation agreement with Mr. Bolden. That was correct. There was no cooperation agreement with Mr. Bolden. Mr. Bolden, after being convicted, evinced some interest in cooperating with the government, but no cooperation deal was ever reached with the government. So Mr. Bolden wasn't within our power to produce. I would note that pages, I believe, 22 through 27 of the initial brief filed on the first appeal in this case mimic the argument that is presented in defendant's brief now. The argument's been switched around a lot, but I think you'll see that the argument is substantially the same. With respect to the tape recordings, many of the issues raised with respect to those tape recordings were waived because they were not raised below. In two cases, I believe the defendant has admitted with respect to Government Exhibit 7 and Government Exhibit 10 that review of this court should be for plain error because there was no objection that was interposed. Preliminarily, as to the other two exhibits, I would just note that the standard of review for the admission of tape recordings is such that there has to be some sort of extraordinary reason to overrule the decision of the district court to admit tape recordings. And there is no such extraordinary reason in this case. Both Government Exhibit 6 and Government Exhibit 8 were supported by an adequate foundation. There were identifications made of the voices of both the defendant and the other speaker on the tapes. The contents of the tape were corroborated by the testimony of the agent witnesses in the sense that they actually indicated, well, this is what this tape was, what we'd planned to do. For example, with respect to Government Exhibit 6, there was testimony that the plan was for, as I mentioned earlier, for the cooperator to call up Mr. Eberhardt and try to arrange some more cocaine to be delivered, and that's what's reflected on the tape itself. And in both instances, with respect to both Government Exhibit 6 and 8, the defense never challenged the accuracy of the tape at trial. More so, they actually challenged what the meaning of the words were that were actually spoken on the tape. Finally, with respect to the Sears instruction, it was, as with the buyer-seller instruction, inconsistent with the theory of defense in this case. There was a concerted effort, which is, continues to today, to suggest that the defendant was actually innocent and that he never conspired with Mr. Bolden. The argument was, A, that there was an alibi defense, and B, that Charles Bolden and the defendant were involved in the music business together. So, for example, with respect to Government Exhibit 6, when there was a discussion of I need two more, and there was some issue of talk of what flavor, the suggestion from the defense during the course of trial was that flavor meant some reference to music, like hip-hop flavor or gospel flavor or something like that. So the requested instruction would have been inconsistent with the theory of defense. Moreover, I think the jury's verdict conclusively establishes that they found the conspiracy took place at times and periods before Bolden cooperated. They returned a special verdict which indicated that they found the conspiracy involved 5 or more kilograms of cocaine. The final tape-recorded conversations related to arranging a meeting for a purchase of two more kilograms of cocaine. So necessarily, the jury's verdict indicated that they believed that the conspiracy started well before Bolden began to cooperate with the government. And after hearing the defendant's confession that the defendant had been getting 20 to 40 kilograms a month from a supplier named Tommy and actually getting the corroboration by the search of the stash house, no reasonable jury would have thought that this conspiracy began on the day that Bolden was arrested, particularly in light of the recorded conversation that took place and the obvious references to prior dealings between the parties that were reflected on those tapes. If the panel has no further questions, I would step down.
Thank you, Mr. Blackburn. Mr. Goodwin?
I'd like to address the factual issue of what was on the tapes.
Well, why did you call Bolden a witness?
You know, Bolden was, first of all, Bolden was cooperating with the government. what Mr. Bachu says is not correct. He was cooperating. He was begging the government to call him as a witness because he wanted a reduction in his sentence.
The question was, did he have an agreement with the government? And the answer is no to that, I assume.
That may be true. Maybe he had a proper agreement. But he did not have any agreement because the government didn't
have
any
agreement. That was the question. He didn't have an agreement.
He wanted, that's true.
If he wanted to cooperate.
He wanted to cooperate. But they were taking his proffers. Up to the time of the trial, they were taking proffers from him. But he was too inconsistent.
But your complaint seems to be that you didn't have a chance to cross examine him. You could have done that just by calling him as an
adverse witness. That's true, Judge. But again, that was our complaint in the prior appeal, the issue of confrontation. You know, the issues that we're addressing today are...
what you're saying is no evidence that, you know, about your client being on the tape. Well, you could have asked Bowden about that. Who is he talking to?
It's true. But, of course, as
you know, the answer would be, of course.
The government has had the burden of proof, and the way Mr. Bachu is we have tape recorded conversations where the informant is talking about money, and the government says they're talking about some drug deal that the defendant had, and the way we know that is because that's what the informant told the agent out of court. Clearly, that is not the proper. If there's something on the tapes, it has to be the defendant's admission. That's the only thing that's admissible on those tapes, is the defendant's admission. And all we have is from Mr. Bachu as well. Mr. Bolton is saying incriminating things, and the defendant is not batting an eye, or the defendant is acting unperturbed. That is not evidence sufficient to support a conspiracy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both all counsel. Mr. Goodman, you have an additional thanks to the court. Mr. Wade, you represent Mr. Everhart through this appellate litigation. Case is taken under advisement. In accordance with proceed to the second case of the day, the United States versus Swan et al. Mr. Rosenberg.
May it please the court, I'm Kenneth Rosenberg for the United States.